it. He put a pillow underneath them to help, then further taken with his desire for more. More adventure. More transcendence. More love. He coaxed her up onto all fours, which did not suit their difference in height. She was forced to assume a downward dog shape. There were several of these shiftings to make them match better. We used to match. We used to match so well, thought Michael. What happened? And at the pinnacle of this disaster, he straightened to full height, straightening her with him. Her hands were flat against the wallpaper, his legs awkwardly bent. He pumped at her, over and over. He couldn't quite reach the place, kept on angling himself in different ways, going harder and harder, until he finally arrived at his own lonely summit, then crashed forth, defeated and upset, his knees buckling. When it was finished, he deflated like the hot air balloon that had lost its flame, pulling her down with him, and they collapsed in a heap on the mattress. They were sweating, embarrassed, crestfallen. It was not what they had planned, not redemptive, not romantic. In the leak of the late raffia moon, Jill's words echoed through the air like a ghost. I stand before you, a divorced woman. They lay there, in the cooling red darkness, in the failure of their feast, unable to look each other in the eye. For they both knew, with a sharp, cold definition, that an endpoint had been reached. Chapter 8. Christmas. Well, thought Michael, if she doesn't find me attractive, someone else will. Mayfair, a week before Christmas, the city dressed up for Jesus, windows aglitter, balconies flashing. Michael was on his way to a fancy black tie, end-of-year trustees event at a fancy restaurant in this, the fanciest part of town, wearing a new suit, shoes polished, coat open to the cold. He never buttoned his coat, and generally experiencing the world differently. It is remarkable how the defining edges of passing women become sharper when love is slipping from your grip. Everywhere he went now, he was aware, like extra vision, like surround sound, of all their shapes, contours, sizes and colours, the olives and browns, the talls and shorts, all the warm and luscious women in the world. He was backtracking up along the John Legend track list. He was regressing to a post-teenage, pre-Melissa state. Just now, for example, on the bus, standing next to him, the soft, voluptuous, gothic brunette with the slightly cruel lips and heavy mauve eyeshadow. He had not been able to help but notice her trembling porcelain cleavage, the jewels in the soft line. And he could not help but think about how she reminded him of Rachel, of what Rachel would look like if she wore more makeup, though he was glad she didn't. Rachel, he hoped, would be there tonight at the trustees' dinner. Rachel found him attractive. The restaurant was almost equal to the Ritz in status terms. Friedland Morton really went to town, literally for their trustees. Among them, aristocrats, lords, a lady, and a baroness with peremptory, stuffed-up voices and static hairdos. Michael never knew what to say to these people. They were virtually another species, even as they shared his citizenship, and he always felt overly conspicuous yet circumferential in their multitudinous presence. Usually, he skirted around the edges of these events, feeling too tall and dark in the middle. He would find a friend or a comfy group and chat in a corner in his cocktail party stance, of palms together, a bit like a priest, head down, feet level, assuming the air of someone who was commanding and entirely calm within, someone dashing and wise. As he approached the venue, he checked himself. Were his lapels straight? Was his shirt tucked in? Were his hands smooth and adequately moisturized? Wondering, as usual, whether he would be the only black person in the room. It was hard to believe, the ice caps melting, the crater expanding, Obama, the recession, the fact of the 21st century in general, that he was still asking himself this question. The last thing he did before entering was turn off his iPod, and he strode on in, ready for whatever. The tables were to one side covered in white. On the other side, people were standing around, drinks in hand, talking. There was a central chandelier and canapes, colourful paintings along the walls, and that mass murmur that rises from parties where people don't dance and becomes louder the more they drink. Rachel was there, wearing a dress of soft purple fabric with a belt at the waist, her long hair falling over her shoulders. When she saw him, there was, he was sure of it, a moment of molten eye contact between them that made it seem perfectly natural, expected, in fact, for him to go over to her and say hey. "Hi," she said. And like the eye contact, this particular hey and hi bore a substance of something that must be attended to, awaiting. He knew, for instance, that sometimes in the dead of a night she thought of him. "Do you know, Michael," Rachel said to the two men she was talking to, sallow creatures in dark suits. "No," they said, all shaking hands. "Michael is one of the CSR team." She turned to him, her eyes wide open, beaming a colluding, let's get out of here beam, or at least that was how he interpreted it. They sat next to each other for dinner. They drank Merlot. On the other side of her was Brendan from HR, and on the other side of Michael was Janet from accounts. "This is good wine," Rachel said. Before that, they'd had champagne. "Your hands are so smooth," she said suddenly, as if about to touch them. Brendan looked at Janet, and Janet looked at Brendan.
"You should play the piano," Janet said.
"That's what people always say," Michael said.
"Honestly, with hands like that, who says a man's hands should be rough and calloused?"
Brendan looked at his own hands. They had panna cotta for dessert, and liqueurs followed by more wine. It began to feel like they all knew each other better than they did, like Rachel was his sweetheart. At one point, he even pressed her leg under the table with his leg, the way people do in films.
"You two, you know what?"
Brendan said, pink-cheeked, referring to Rachel and Michael.
"You two would make a very good-looking couple. Do you know that?"
Oh, alcohol, this most joyous of drugs.
"I feel like dancing," said Rachel.
"I do too," said Michael. "Let's get out of here," cried Brendan.
It's funny when you're drinking how the place you started begins to feel like another day, and you're someone else. Someone not quite Michael, nor quite Rachel, or Janet, or Brendan. All of them heightened, connected, turned up yet somehow muffled, walking, teetering out the door through which they had entered as themselves. Into the night riot of festive lights they went, the late Mayfair traffic, leaving the trustees behind. They ended up at the Dover Street Wine Bar, a place for the mature raver. Lots of people in their 40s and 50s, in sparkly dresses, dancing to assorted disco and some live jazz.
"We are fully booked,"
the thickly rouged woman at the door said in a Romanian accent.
"We don't want to eat, we just want to dance," Janet said. "We are fully booked," she said again.
"But look at them," Brendan said of Rachel and Michael. "They just got married. They've come all the way from Leicester."
A crowd of people left, so she let them in. They went down shiny, disco-y stairs, the fake newlyweds holding hands for a minute, and Michael didn't even think of Melissa all the time they were there, apart from once, when he was waiting to be served at the bar, and he began to feel tired and had a sudden yearning for her. He imagined arriving home to the quiet house in the quiet night, and she would be waiting for him in her cappuccino slip, reading Hemingway, smiling at the sentences. He would walk into the red, she would lay her book aside, lift her arms, and he would accentuate the smallness of her breastplate by laying his head against it. He could not help but compare them, Rachel and Melissa. As he returned to the dance floor with another round of cocktails, Melissa's small breastplate, Rachel's larger breastplate, Melissa's smaller feet, Rachel's bigger feet, which danced differently from the way Melissa danced. He liked dancing with Rachel. Legend was echoing in his ears, singing to him of the weakness of his nature, how the conflicting sides of him were yet to be reconciled. Her eyes, their uncommon clarity. True, naked eyes. Eyes that did not slide away like Melissa's eyes, did not hide from him or hold anything back. Attractions like these, John said,
are ordained by the angels. They are droplets of bliss to make us remember our aliveness. And should they not be followed? When the switch is turned on, should the light not be made use of, the room walked into, the carpet walked, the sheets troubled? Yes, they should. Michael agreed emphatically from his tequila high. She swirled in her Shinzano high. And he watched her. Her shining teeth, her cream-coloured neck. She was virtually off the hizzle. She was possibly worthy of 100%. I want to make your zoom zoom go boom boom.
How old are you?
He shouted.
25? How old are you?
37.
This aroused secret checks for compatibility. Positive speculations. Next thing, they were in the Christmassy street, and Janet and Brendan were nowhere to be seen.
I'm so pissed, she said.
Me too.
Next thing, they were in a cab, going her way, east, to Whitechapel.
I didn't know people even lived in Whitechapel, Michael said.
I love Whitechapel.
You must be loaded.
I'm not. I work on phones, remember?
But it turns out that you don't have to be loaded to live in Whitechapel, for there are many kinds of digs all across London to suit every budget. This, a tiny flat, with two bedrooms and a kitchen, living room and dining room all in one. Rachel's flatmate was asleep.
Shh,
she said, as she went ahead of him up the stairs, he studying her ankles, inferior to Melissa's ankles, yet pleasing, stirring. So the cooker was in the same room as the sofa, and there was a smell of recent dinner. And in Rachel's room, there was a sink in the corner, like there had been a sink in the corner of Melissa's old room in Kensal Rise, where they had first met Desdemona and Angelina. It bothered Michael, the sink. It made him sad, and he wanted to run away back to his own woman and her Hemingway. Around the sink, there was some dirt where the grout had fallen away, which also bothered him, deeply. He tore his eyes away from the sink, away from anything to do with Melissa or his actual grown-up life. Here they were. Rachel. Rachel's room. Rachel finds me attractive.
I'll put on some music, she said.
Boys to Men lifted out from the CD player on the dressing table. They had another drink. It began predictably with,
I don't normally do this kind of thing.
Their kiss was no Desdemona. No distant relation whatsoever. It was too drunken, too wet. They did not know each other, had not laughed enough together to make it comparable. On her bed was a purpley blue bedspread with ridges in it, which was quite coarse and uncomfortable. They did not make it under this bedspread but stayed on top. The whole thing was fast. All the way through, there was an awareness that Michael would probably leave soon afterwards. She unbuckled him. He pulled up her dress, and in the speed of it, they became glorious. She straddled him, her hair brushing his shoulder. He managed, almost completely through it, to erase Melissa from the shadows of this experience. She was only a small ghost floating in the vicinity of the sink, and it was not until the end, when Rachel piled on top of him in a shuddering mass of moistness, that Melissa, and with her Rhea, Blake, his mum, dad, brother and Auntie Cynthia, his father's sister in America, gathered in an appalled congregation around the hard, purpley blue sea.
Oh, I like you, Rachel said.
That was... wow, he said, into the collapsed curtain of her hair, which got caught in his throat so that he started to cough. The coughing was such that she felt obliged to roll off him. And once that was done, any tenderness that might have concluded things seemed inappropriate. She got him some water from the tap at the sink. That sink, from which he could only take a minuscule, polite sip, first because of the traumatic emotional connotations of the sink, and also because it was essentially Thames bath water, not technically drinkable, which made him think badly of her. She covered herself in her dressing gown and sat back down on the edge of the bed. Rachel.
Shh, I know. I know, I know, I know.
Yeah?
It's late.
I better go. He quickly washed, kissed her on the cheek, found his other sock, checked his lapels, and went to find a night bus. All the way across the water into the south, he felt like a shit. How would he face them? What had happened to his careful percentages system? Had he become so desperate as to engage in such seedy one-night-stand behaviour? What if she found out? What if he talked about it in his sleep? He felt sullied, frightened. The Christmas lights laughed and pulsed in his face as he walked back from Cobb's Corner. He tried to remember what he was before, how pure he was, how righteous, to place it, but he couldn't. When he opened the door, he was startled to find Melissa walking up the stairs in her cotton nightdress. It was 4 a.m.
"Oh, hi,"
he said, so happy to see her nevertheless.
"Hi,"
she said. There was that immediate warmth between them, that first, indestructible warmth that stays even when love itself is going. She had come down for medicine. Blake had been coughing. Michael felt the need to explain his lateness.
"I had to get 3 night buses. I couldn't get a cab. I only had £10 on me."
It was the first lie of this kind, and it made him feel even shitter. The Christmas tree was ruled by an angel. She had a fine kingdom. It seemed to float above its glossy mound of presents. A mist came off of it. The magical mingling of tinsel with fairy lights, of dust and pale daylight from the bay window, of faded olive green foliage with many colours and forms of decorative bauble. The tree was bought from Woolworths in 1978. The baubles were stored throughout the year in their original partitioned boxes in the attic until it was time to radiate and scintillate. They were planets with curly waves of gold glitter circling around. They were purple discs with pink combs at their edges. They were icicles and snowmen, foil-wrapped Santas made of chocolate, which over the course of the day were unwrapped and eaten by the various children and adults liming in the armchairs, corners, and nooks and crannies of the old house. The angel sat on top of it all, in a long white dress and halo, watching over with inanimate blindness. The blindness of Cornelius, Melissa's father, however, was animate. Pertaining to one eye, his left, a recent result of accelerated glaucoma. With his other eye, he went about the usual events of his 8.5-decade life, which were pegged in a neat, supportive order along a mental washing line leading towards the final eclipse. Wake up, watch television, smoke, shave and dress, smoke, watch television with lunch, smoke, watch television with dinner, smoke, go to bed, smoke in the middle of the night if happened to be awake. In macro terms, there was Easter, birthdays, and of course, Christmas. Christmas was the largest of these events, and although he lived alone now, it was done in the same way he had always done it, with copious papery and tinselly adornment. With just one eye, and albeit sharpening eye, in the demise of its friends, and with the help of Adele, the oldest daughter, who lived on his side of the river, in the 3rd week of December, Cornelius gathered the boxes of decorations on the dining table and checked their contents. From ladders, lengths of motley patterns went up. They crisscrossed the ceiling and frilled the cornices, obedient to their drawing pins, for Cornelius would not be able to handle the event of a failed drawing pin, a collapsed frill, living alone as he did, and no one there to fix it for him. So they used hammers. Up went the festive Chinese chandeliers in the hallway. Over the mantelpiece went the string of Christmas cards from what was left of his family in the north. And there they all stayed until no later than midnight on the 5th day of January. That is, of course, the 12th day of Christmas, when Adele returned to help him take them back down. Adele had 2 children, Warren and Lauren, 19 and 17. They always came to visit Cornelius on Boxing Day. Carol came with her 5-year-old son, Clay, Melissa and Michael with Rhea and Blake, and finally, Alice, their homeland connection and matriarch, who also lived alone now, in a little flat in Kilburn. She and Cornelius maintained a cordial communication with one another for the sake of festive family occasions like these. Long gone were the days of Cornelius's fearsome dictatorship, when he had ruled over the house with a strict disciplinarian regime and large amounts of alcohol. Now he was just a withered, white-haired old man with high anxiety levels, and everyone did their best to pretend it had all never happened. It was a lot to handle for Cornelius, this sudden crowd of people in his space, their strange urbanesque speech, the unbearable mass displacement of kitchen items and other household wares that he desperately needed to be in their rightful places. He spent much of the time shuffling around with his walking stick, picking things up and questioning people angrily about whether they belonged to them. Meanwhile, he drank lots of wine, which gradually made his lips go purple, and smoked cigarettes to their starkest conclusions. The air smelt of tobacco and damp plaster. Carpets were curling from their corners, emitting tiny screams from the 70s. Currently, he was sitting in his green chair, TV-centered, a wrinkled leather pouf by his feet, next to a knee-high table upon which he dealt with business, lunch and dinner, the cleaning of one-sided bifocals, the unwrapping of presents, for which he used scissors. Rhea was sitting on the floor next to him, as she often did when they came here. She felt a wild pity for him, and a fascination and a distance. He was so old. He couldn't jump. He couldn't run. He was like an old street that had been rained on, and walked on, and wheeled on, and hailed on for a long time. There were potholes and dents all over his face. His hands were grey-veined, like the remains of a Mercury volcano, and somehow blind also. At intervals, she watched him, by way of exploration, which Cornelius did not seem to mind or notice. Warren and Lauren were sitting on one arm each of the sofa, with Melissa and Carol between them, talking about yoga, specifically how long to hold the warrior poses of the primary series. Michael was over at the dining table, beyond the partition, drinking dragon stout and playing with Blake, while Alice and Adele were in the kitchen with Clay. The TV was on. Conversations rose and fell. Lauren was talking about her forthcoming 18th birthday plans.
"I'm gonna hire a limo,"
she said. "A pink one." Rhea asked what a limo was.
"It's one of those stupid long cars with twats inside it," Warren said.
He was wearing a red sweatshirt with Gold Digger printed across the front.
"What's a twat?"
"Language, Warren, please," Melissa said.
She hated being in this house. Every time she came here, she tried not to stay for too long, and she found it difficult to converse directly with her father. She could still see thunder in his eyes. When she was a child, that thunder had felt as if it could break the house, as if the house were made of glass. It was always easier when Carol was here too.
"You can hire one for £70,
Lauren was saying, holding a hot comb which she was pulling down through her weave.
"They've got TVs inside. You just drive around, drive to the club, whatever. They take you home afterwards as well."
"Yeah, and who's paying for it?"
Warren said.
"I have a job. I can pay for it myself, innit?"
"It's my birthday too," Rhea said. "I'm going to be 8. Can I get a limo?"
This made everyone laugh. Cornelius said, "Shh," turning up the TV. He was trying to watch Dad's Army. From the kitchen, Adele came in looking flustered.
"Isn't anyone going to help with the food?"
She was hard done by and taken for granted, but at the same time, she did not want to relinquish control of the food, and when Michael went in to help, she eventually told him he wasn't needed, muttering that Carol should help because she hadn't done anything yet and never did.
"What are you doing to your hair, Lauren? Are you relaxing it?" Carol said.
She sported dreadlocks and believed in the Nubian approach to the contested afro follicle.
"I'm straight combing it."
"You should just be natural. Just be you. Be free."
Lauren had smoke lifting off her head. She was trying her best to supersede herself. Her hair had once belonged to someone else, someone Indian, she revealed, which was why it had been expensive. Her eyebrows were drawn on, sharply defined and dark. She wore tight blue jeans and a yellow blouse, a similar colour to her skin, upon which, once a week, she applied bronzing cream to darken her too light beige nation complexion. She was a fantasy of herself, permanently materialising.
You're hot-combing someone else's hair, Melissa said.
It's my hair.
It's on her head, Warren confirmed. So is her hair. Meanwhile, Rhea and Clay had gone out into the hall and were sitting halfway up the stairs. They were eating the chocolate Santas and playing with Clay's stickers.
I've got lots of bones in my body, Rhea said to Clay.
I haven't, said Clay.
Yes, you have. You've got one here, here, here.
She pointed at them.
No,
Clay said.
I haven't got any bones. I've only got one bone in my belly button.
And he pulled up his jumper to show it to her. Back in the living room, the adverts were on. Warren was watching music videos on his tablet. Cornelius was intrigued by this new kind of screen, smaller, maybe better for one eye. He watched it. People, things passed across it. Music of the new world. Rappers with bulky arms and tattoos and very white teeth. I saw you on Facebook last week, Melissa said to Lauren.
Is it? What did you think of my Facebook page?
It was nice. Melissa was not much of a user.
Thanks,
Lauren said.
Let's see it.
Warren looked at Lauren's phone. Both their phones were ever out. There was a group Facebook perusal, meanwhile watching the music. A tune was on, 50 Cent's In Da Club.
Is that P. Fiddy?
Cornelius said suddenly, his voice breaking into the midst of them with a familiar foreign tone, soaked in the building fog of senility.
I think you mean Puff Daddy, Warren said.
But I thought he changed his name.
Warren and Lauren were astounded by their grandfather's unexpected pop culture awareness. It was particularly surprising, because these days he said a lot of things twice and forgot names, and the names within the names, words like table and wire.
He did change his name, Warren said. He changed it to P. Diddy, though.
Well, that's what I said.
No, Diddy, said Lauren, not Fiddy.
But isn't there someone called Fiddy?
Cornelius said, confused.
Oh, Fiddy, Warren laughed. You mean 50 Cent. He's called Fiddy for short.
Into the room now came Alice, wading, gliding, her head up, her glasses shining in the light of the ancient chandelier, her wrapper and slippers swishing, holding a glass of sherry. She took a seat by the window, the Christmas tree floating next to her, adding to her mysterious light. She was looking forward to going back to her empty pink flat. On the subject of yoga, she felt that both Melissa and Carol were foolish to try and keep it up while raising children, and she regularly told them so. And on the subject of night things, which Melissa had talked to her about upstairs earlier, Alice had various recommendations. You hang up some garlic by the front door, cut an onion in half and leave it on the windowsill, put Vicks on the place where the night thing is coming, and some cayenne pepper on top of it, and you pray.
Another thing, she said.
After taking a sip of her sherry, the voices continuing on in the background.
Use salt water in the bath and make it very, very hot.
Okay, Mum, Melissa said dubiously.
And sometimes you put one plantain under your pillow at night.
What? A whole plantain?
Yes, it stops it going inside your mind.
Of this last observation, Melissa took no notice whatsoever. She had also dismissed her mother's theory that if there was a night thing in her house, it was because it had a downstairs bathroom.
One day, you get a better house than that, Alice said.
2 days after Christmas was Rhea's birthday, and around that time, two things happened that convinced Melissa, once and for all, that there was something jinxed about 13 Paradise Row. The first was to do with fire. For Rhea's fourth birthday, she had been given a fairy dress with wings. She had immediately put it on and climbed onto the sofa. She had stood there, preparing herself, anticipating the first hover and the higher air. When this did not happen, when she had simply landed on the floor like any other jump, she had shouted,
"Mummy, these wings don't work. You have to buy me some more."
So every year now, they went to the theatre, Melissa with Rhea,
to offer her flight of another kind, to reward that she had so deeply believed. This year, they were going to see The Nutcracker, a first ballet. Rhea wore a new black dress with sequins across the bodice and a full skirt that became a semicircle when she lifted it at both sides, which she did, standing beneath the skylight, then soaring down the stairs with the black satin billowing after her. Before they left, Melissa told her to put some cream on her hands because her skin was dry. They took the train into town, Rhea's feet just touching the floor, swinging. Melissa felt an enormous pride in her and a great protection. They saw the blue-lit trees along the riverbank, the misty dome of St. Paul's in the distance. The whole city was blazing, the lights all around, the way they fell and danced on the water.
"I like having my birthday for Christmas," Rhea said as they walked along the Strand.
She ran ahead as usual, her red tights sparkling. A dirty city wind was blowing, and it occurred to Melissa that Rhea was who she was, in part because of this city, that she, they both, belonged to it. The lobby of the theatre was crowded. They went up a circular staircase and found their seats near the back of the auditorium. They were high up, the stage waited, closed and secret, to give the afternoon a dream. Soon the curtain rose, and here was Christmas, most of all, a giant tree in the corner surrounded by presents, a pretty, ornate room in a made-up house. The orchestra was gold and silver, lit up in the pit with the conductor's dancing arms. A little girl, Clara, tiptoed into the room, and then the bigger dancing began. The ballerinas were synchrony, together on their toes, weaving across the space. Rhea stared at them, straight-backed. She whispered,
"I can't believe my eyes."
The simultaneous arms, the turns and glides, the certainty of direction.
"How do they know what to do?"
Melissa told her they'd been practicing.
"But how can they point their toes like that?"
Then,
"Why is Clara dancing in her pajamas?"
And,
"Why is the Christmas tree made of paper?"
Meanwhile, sucking on a lemon chupa chup.
"Is that blue man the handsome prince?" she asked. "Is that the king mouse? Is that real snow?"
All this before the interval. After the interval,
"Why is that gold thing on the curtain going up? Why didn't those people on the stage have any food? I don't believe that Clara's still wearing her pajamas. Is it finished? Is it finished now?"
Back out in the lobby, from the bottom of the circular staircase, Melissa took a picture of Rhea standing at the top, holding up her skirt in a semicircle. One foot was in front of the other. Her legs were crossed, as if infected by the ballet. There was a smiling look on her face, containing the kindness and selfishness of children. This would be the last picture of her taken on two good feet. But first, the fire, which happened that evening over the birthday cake. Rhea was sitting at the dining table, still wearing her dress, and Michael was standing opposite her, holding Blake. 8 candles. The lights went down. Melissa emerged from the paprika glow of the kitchen, with the cake as they were singing. There was a feeling of deep togetherness in this singing, that in the singing was the ribbon that linked them all together, and Michael lost his sense of nagging unease for a moment, and laid his hand lightly on Melissa's back. Melissa put the cake down on the table. When Rhea bent to blow out the candles, her loose hair got caught in a flame, and the flame then lifted. A high orange sweep went up, quickly monstrous. To Rhea, it felt like just some warm air by her neck. What upset her was the sudden look of horror on her father's face, even on Blake's face. Frantically, Melissa batted her hand against the flame. It went out, and Rhea was not hurt. But the image stayed there in Melissa's mind. A burning child's head. A terror at the dining table. It was another bad omen. A week later, Melissa and Rhea went to the woods to find the tunnel, as they had said they would. The tunnel, where the train got stuck on the way to the Crystal Palace. They entered the woods from the street, and walked down the dark, uneven path to the clearing, where the light opened out and there were stretches of thin, tall oaks and hornbeams. The sound of the traffic slipped away. There were only birds and the rustling of the trees above. They had stood for centuries, these trees. They had witnessed the walking of yesterday's beasts, the egrets, the beavers. There were bats and owls here, and three kinds of woodpecker. Dogs flashed through the trunks, their tails in the air, upward with freedom.
"Can we go inside the tunnel?"
Rhea said as they walked. A bit of her hair on one side of her head was shorter than the rest and singed a lighter brown. "I think it's sealed," Melissa said, "but let's see." They reached the footbridge from which Camille Pissarro had painted the view of his time, a pale, open sky, a train taking a bend away from him, empty fields on either side. They went past the algae pond that didn't move and threw a stick on it and watched it not sink, past the golf course and the rope swing, and eventually, at the bottom of a slope, they came to the tunnel entrance. It was black, sealed shut. A tiny blue bird flew out from a slit at the top. Rhea was disappointed. She had wanted to walk all the way through it, to the glass world on the other side. She had wanted to see Leona Dare hanging from her hot air balloon, doing gymnastics in the sky.
"I saw pictures of her," she said. "She used to hang from her mouth. It cost 1 shilling to watch. How much is 1 shilling?
"About 10 pence. Rhea imagined crowds of people in long dresses and high hats at the other end of the tunnel, looking up at Leona. Melissa imagined it too, walking through the tunnel, past the ghostly abandoned train, and it was very quiet, and she was walking into history. Michael was not there. He did not exist. They did not exist. It was a beautiful kind of solitude. The way was wide enough for 2 people to walk side by side. When she got there, she wandered through the courts, saw the frescoes and tombs, and the lions in a circle in Alhambra, and had a glass of rhubarb champagne. "We should go back," she said. The light was changing. "It's going to get dark soon."
"Okay,"
Rhea said. They began making their way back up the slope. That was when the second thing happened. Just as they reached the top, Rhea stumbled in the mud and twisted her ankle. She carried on walking, but near the algae pond, she stumbled again and started to cry. She held on to Melissa, hopping and limping, or being half-carried, for the rest of the way out of the woods. By the time they got back to the car, it was dark, and her ankle had swollen to the size of a tennis ball. Instead of going home, they went to the hospital. The ankle bone was fractured on the outer edge. She would wear a cast for 2 weeks. She lay on her front on the stretcher as the nurse arranged plaster of Paris around her thin, brown calf. She fell asleep like that and dreamt of the palace. It was after midnight in the London borough of Lewisham.
Chapter 9. Confession. The man on the radio was saying, "We're always reminding them, myself and my wife, that we're a gang, we're a team, we work together, and anything we've got because we all make it happen. So say they ask for the latest DS game or whatever, we'll say to them, well, there are some children who don't have a DS at all, let alone the latest game, and we'll encourage them to do something else with their time if they're bored, like play cards. We play cards with them a lot. Play games, you know, remind them of the concept of the team, encourage them to make the most of what they already have. That's not to say that they never get what they ask for, because they do, only in moderation. And we never do that thing, that terrible thing of going on about how much things cost and how hard we had to work to buy them. But we try and make sure they appreciate things. And really, as a result, birthdays and Christmases and Easter and all that are no big deal to them. It's not this crazy extravaganza of presents and things. It's a time when they get to see their grandparents a bit more, some quality time with the family, you know? So it's about what we teach them, the messages we're sending them as they grow up." Despite the irritating, sanctimonious, somewhat nasal voice of this anonymous parent, Melissa was making a mental note, while driving the children to soft play, of the worthier elements of his sermon. The importance of the team. The thing about not going on about how much things cost.
which of course was terrible, and she was racked with guilt and self-loathing at the thought of yesterday, when she had told Rhea off for putting her Hello Kitty cool cards in the bath as part of an impromptu science project, stating that they had cost £27. What, indeed, was £27 to an 8-year-old? An 8-year-old on crutches, with a hard white left leg, who was isolated from her school friends and needed to find in-house entertainment to keep her occupied. That cool cards experiment had been conducted on one leg, bending over the bath, with the bad leg supported by its big toe and the crutches leaning against the wall. She had limped there, as she limped everywhere, clattering around the rooms, hopping, leaning, holding, sometimes swinging a crutch around and throwing things off the bookshelves. But how determined, how exploratory, how imaginative, how much more physical and disability-refuting than sitting on the sofa watching CBeebies. And all Melissa could do was berate her for it. On and off for the last 9 days, after an initial appearance at school, where Rhea received leave of absence and immediate celebrity status, Lord have mercy, what happened to your foot? And, wow, let's have a go on your crutches. She and Melissa had been united in their daytime occupation of 13 Paradise Row. Melissa spent as much time as she could in her office working, and the rest of the time with Rhea, making lunch, making snacks, encouraging homework, ensuring adequate fresh air through occasional walks and clattering expeditions into the garden. There is only so much you can do with a leg in Paris. No running, no swimming, no scooting. All is hoppy and slowed and sedentary. And Rhea spent many hours sitting at the dining table engrossed in imaginary worlds made of Lego, Peppa Pig furniture, and chess pieces, muttering to herself, enjoying her freedom from fractions and this new, homely independence, while Melissa longed inwardly for her to go back to school. When Blake was home with them, like today, Friday, a freezing, dreary morning in the second week of January, it was worse, and she had decided on the expedition to Softplay to make things easier. It was not the obvious place to take a cripple. She couldn't climb, she couldn't slide, but perhaps she could sit on the edge of the ball pond, and she and Blake could throw balls at each other. Or she could roll around on the cushioning, or fiddle with the netting, while Melissa, she hoped, could finish her column. She was late with her deadline. It had been cumbersome getting them both into the car. Blake and his straps, and Rhea with her crutches. There had been hardly any time for Melissa to make herself look nice. She was wearing her grey anorak with the roughly sewed-up rip in the hem, a beige jumper accentuating the thus far unflattened calamity of her postnatal stomach, and her trainers, which were still muddy from the fateful walk in the woods. She had applied some lip gloss at the last minute, but this, apparently, was the only allusion left to the high-flying, world-eating woman who had once edited the fashion and lifestyle pages of Open. She had put the radio on to provide an alternative to her bad mood and the chattering in the back.
"Mummy, when my cast comes off, can I go swimming with Shanita, Shakira and Emily? Mummy, where did you put that brat doll that came with my shoe? Mummy, did you know that little lies lead to big lies and big lies lead to terrible lies?"
They were passing Tesco Express. A drizzle was falling onto the windscreen. She turned the radio over to Radio 4, Woman's Hour. Jenny Murray's soothing, determined voice, a moment of reinforcement, a reminder. She turned up the volume.
"Mummy, can you turn it down, please?"
Rhea said. "I'm listening to it."
"But it's too loud, and I can't read."
"You're not reading, you're talking."
"Now I'm reading."
"Oh, now you're reading. What about me? What about what I want? I am a person too, you know. I have desires and pastimes and hobbies, thoughts, emotions and feelings too. What am I supposed to do while you're so desperately reading? Just sit here looking at this grey street, this grey rain, huh?"
"Oh, just forget it."
Urged again by guilt, Melissa turned it down a tiny bit. Then Blake started to cry. She tried to calm him down by reaching back and holding his foot, which did nothing for him.
"He's tired,"
said Rhea, smugly familiar with his not-quite-working Gina Ford routine.
"Now, Blake, remember what we told you."
she said.
You wake up in the morning, and then in the daytime you can have two little sleeps and one big nap, then an enormous sleep all night long. And then you wake up again in the morning, and you do the same thing over and over and over and over again. Okay?
To this, he cried harder, obliterating the radio. He cried all the rest of the way to Little Scamps, apart from just as they got there, when he unhelpfully fell asleep. There was further clattering getting Rhea out of the car, the unfolding of the heavy McLaren, which Blake didn't want to inhabit just now. So Melissa carried him with one arm, pushed the pram with the other, and the three of them proceeded awkwardly through the icy, wet air into the house of hell. The path to Little Scamps is a three-turn slope downwards into an underground dungeon composed of primary-coloured apparatus, shoe pouches, and a small cafe. On the first slope, you brace yourself. On the second slope, you sense that you are drowning. On the third, you are fully submerged. You hear the shrieks, cries, and wails of scamps of all sizes and ages, and that is the only music. You are surrounded by netting and padding. Everything is padded. The walls of the ball pond, the runways of the fun, netted tunnels, the stairs going up to the fantastic curvy slide, and the landing strip at the bottom. The scamps bounce and cling against the netting, their shoes stored in the red, yellow, and blue pouches, running, leaping, climbing, whooshing. Their mothers, and generally not their fathers, sit nearby, on hard wooden chairs with lines lengthening on their faces, cowering over their beverages, or even reading material, if they are very ambitious about this being a chance for me time, amid the frequent requests for crisps, juice, toilet, inter-scamp conflict resolution, and alternative entertainment if they are bored. And then there is the other kind of mother, who takes a more hands-on approach, or rather, feet, who has taken off her shoes, who steps, flushed and clammy of forehead, into the ball pond to help her baby enjoy the blowing machine, which makes the balls hover in the air with a clever magnetic mechanism. She dangles little Jimmy, or whoever it is, above it, and he laughs and laughs, she hopes, or else just dangles there, feeling windswept and bewildered, at which she presently deposits him back on the padded floor and lets him sit, and she will also sit, with her legs tucked underneath her in minimal comfort, maybe chatting to another of these mothers who is also sitting in the ball pond, both accepting that although they are two large bodies obstructing some of the children's passage between net tunnels, they have just as much right and purpose to be there, more in fact, because they are needed. Melissa belonged to the former of these categories. "How many children are you signing in?" said the green-shirted little scamps warden at the desk. "Two." The girl looked Rhea up and down, taking in the crutches in her armpits, and tentatively handed Melissa two wristbands. "Sign them in, please," she said, pressing the gate release button. It swung open, bright yellow and also netted, and submersion was complete. The ball blower wasn't working today. Some of the children were using it instead for something to stand on and jump off, but the babies weren't interested. It being a school day, Rhea was the only one here of school age. There was no one for her to strike up a spontaneous, soon-to-be-forgotten friendship with. She would not be able to climb the nets or run through the tunnels, only play alone amidst the padding, or be a medium-sized duck. Permeating the thick subterranean air was a warm smell of food additives and coffee, of cheese toasties lately consumed, evidenced by some stray crusts on the floor by one of the chair legs. Melissa made her way to a relatively deserted corner, steering the pram along a crooked path between the chairs and tables, with Blake still hoisted by her free arm. Rhea followed and took a seat at their table, while Melissa removed Blake's shoes. Nearby, two women sat talking. Another sat alone over a newspaper.
"Mummy, can I have some crisps?"
Rhea said. "We just got here. Go and play."
"But I can't."
"Yes, you can. Go on, take off your shoe. Wait, put some cream on first. I told you, you need to keep creaming your hands. Why are they so dry all the time?"
"I don't know."
She creamed her hands and took off the one proper shoe. The other was a huge felt flip-flop designed for legs in plaster. Melissa put the three shoes in the pouches, and Blake in the ball pond, asking Rhea to keep him entertained. She watched her for a while. She was lovely in her limping, in her flared blue skirt, her one actual thin leg sticking out of it. She and Blake threw balls at each other, laughing, while Melissa ventured tentatively back to her corner and took out her laptop. It was difficult to concentrate, trying to keep one watchful eye at the same time, but she managed to write a sentence. Soon, though, there was an approach of Ugg boots, a powder blue coat, a large four-wheeler.
"Hi, Melissa!"
a voice said. It was Donna, a motherland acquaintance, also frequently run into at the local playgrounds and in the Isles of Japan. She motioned to take a seat, but Melissa was not quite smiling, her fingers shadowing the keyboard.
"Oh, sorry!"
Donna paused with her vehicle.
"Am I disturbing you?"
"No, no, it's okay. Sit down." Donna wore blue glasses the same color as her coat. The eyes behind them seemed always staring and blank. Through her light, foodie chatter about mousse preferences, good cakes, the difference in quality, for example, between a low-fat Marks and Spencer's blueberry muffin and a Sainsbury's low-fat blueberry muffin. There was no one who could beat Marks and Spencer's for their low-fat muffins. "I'm more of a savoury person," Melissa said. "Give me a packet of crisps over a donut any day." The more they talked, the more the world receded. They were sinking. The dungeon was going down deeper and deeper. Around them, the voices of the scamps whipped through the air, beneath the ugly neon lights, beneath the ground itself. And among these shouts came a sharp, distinctive cry belonging only to Blake. He was lying on his front on the padding, crying. Rhea was limping back over to the table with only one crutch.
"Mummy, Blake's stuck in the balls."
"Where's your other crutch?"
"I don't know."
"What do you mean you don't know?"
"I don't know."
"Well, where did you leave it?"
"I don't know."
Melissa collected Blake and went to look for the other crutch, which she found lying under a table. Blake didn't want to play in the pond anymore. He wanted to go inside the tunnels, to rise into the upper echelons of the netting like the bigger kids. But the only way he could do this would be for his mother to aid and accompany him, and thus take off her shoes. Intent on his wish, he lunged towards one of the padded mounts leading to the first level.
"Blake, come here!" "Blake, you can't go up there!" Melissa said.
He arrived at the mount and pulled himself up to standing, attempted to mount it, cried when he couldn't, and looked around for his mum. She was now on all fours. Donna was watching with her staring eyes. Melissa entered the tunnel, keeping her shoed feet outside, trying to coax him away.
"Sweetheart, you're too small. Come here. Come out."
Then he was wailing, mouth wide open, full volume, throat visible. At some point in the parenting war between what you know you should do and what you do not want to do, there is capitulation. You must let go of yourself, perhaps only for a little while, though these many little whiles may gradually build into larger and larger whiles, joining together like cells and building another person, until you are no longer quite yourself. There was her son, her crying little crawling son, who only wanted to rise, and how could she deny him this, when she had already denied her crippled daughter the full enjoyment of a wet Hello Kitty science experiment? When you try to be selfish in a situation that requires selflessness, there is unhappiness. There was only one thing to do.
"Okay, Blake," she said.
"Okay." She sat down on the bright red padded ground. They would climb together. They would rise. She untied her muddy laces, took off her trainers, and placed them in the pouch next to the others. After lunch, the mouse man came back to paradise, which looked more and more now like a live, menacing structure with its white and stony face and those two window eyes looking out, holding in. Dust was swirling in the air. The crooked floors were getting crookeder. The narrow hall was getting narrower. During lunch, Rhea refused to eat her fish fingers.
"Don't cut them,"
she ordered. So Melissa cut them out of spite.
"Mummy, if you do that again, you'll make me angry, okay?"
And she left them on her plate, also out of spite. Melissa considered what to do about this affront. Should she force them down her throat, punish her over a fish finger? Motherhood is an obliteration of the self, she said.
What?
Rhea said. Pardon, not what.
Pardon? What?
Motherhood is... Then came that tight, British knock at the door. She recognized it. Rentokil. The same anorak and hat. The same Hitler moustache.
So,
he said, striding into the kitchen with his clipboard. This was his third and final visit. Rhea stared at him from the table with her scaly hands.
Any other sightings? Any bait bites? Drop-ins?
Bait bites?
Rhea said.
What's bait bites?
Blake was careening out of his high chair in such a way that it looked like it was about to tip over, so Melissa got him out of it. He shoved some mashed potato into her ear, found this hilarious, and tried to do it again. Meanwhile, she provided a mouse update. No more sightings, no droppings.
I didn't check the bait, though.
Ah, he said, loudly, bending down by the kickboards.
This one's been eaten into. Look.
There were sinister bites in the blue poison, which meant that something was dying, here, in these walls, or was already dead. The corpse could be anywhere.
Do you know when? When it was eaten, I mean, how long it takes for them to die?
Oh, who knows, who knows, the rent-a-kill man said, apparently satisfied at the opportunity presented by the question.
It depends on the size and the constitution of the little fella, whether it managed to make it outside before the poison began to take effect. Inside deaths definitely take longer. The cold speeds things up a bit, you see. But I would say...
He rubbed his chin.
Judging on the size of the bites here, that it's a smallish mouse. The smaller they are, the quicker they go, and the less likely they are to get outside. They don't want to go outside, that's the thing. Especially when they're expiring. They want to stay here in the warm chamber.
Melissa laughed. The warm chamber. So much information, so much specificity. The rentokil man didn't think it was funny. He looked at her, mystified, his eyes glinting with empathy for the soul of the lost one who had bitten. And suddenly, Melissa thought of Bridget. Bridget had wanted to leave this house. That was why she'd lied about the mice. Why she'd tried to keep Lily hidden away in her room. The house was poisoned. There was something wrong with it. Bridget had wanted to get out of here, and she hadn't wanted to let anything stand in her way.
Actually, is there anything else? She asked the rent-a-kill man. I'm kind of busy, so...
Onions. Garlic by the front door. What else had her mother said?
I just need to print off your invoice, he said, sitting down opposite Rhea and getting out his nifty machine again. Don't worry about the invoice. Post it to me.
She practically threw him out. He started to say something more about the mice. Something conclusive. A rounding off. Handing over to her the baton of kindly extermination. But she had no ears left for it. He scuttled away, letting the gate slam after him. It was January in Lewisham. And she was still in Lewisham. In the London borough of... Lidl was cheaper. How ingenious that Dieter Schwartz, who had made it possible to buy granola for a quarter of the price you could get it for in Japan. How much cheaper their chicken, their kitchen towel, their fruit juice and their vegetables, all of adequate quality if you stayed away from the lowliest brands. It was half factory, half shop. Why go to the trouble of taking hundreds